Vision is going to hear the case of people against Alexander. Ms. Kelly, I see you're set and ready to go. We'll hear from you.
Good afternoon. My name is Nora Kelly. My attorney number is 16541. May it please the court and counsel. This case is about multiple burglaries which occurred in Jefferson County in the fall of 2006. Mr. Alexander, the defendant, pleaded guilty to two of the burglaries for which he was charged. The prosecution brought in evidence from those burglaries along with evidence from burglaries that were committed in Boulder under Colorado Rule of Evidence 404B. Our claim is that the fact that this evidence was admitted along with other evidence at the trial leads to the conclusion that Mr. Alexander did not receive a fair trial and that his conviction should be reversed and the matter remanded for a new trial. I'll go over now the evidence that we claim should not have been allowed and the admission of which requires a new trial for Mr. Alexander. First is the 404B evidence. One group of this evidence was the Boulder burglaries. And that evidence of these Boulder burglaries was so remote from Mr. Alexander that it cannot be said that it was not prejudicial to bring in that.
Was it really evidence of Boulder burglaries, or was it evidence of property from Boulder residents found in the truck that Mr. Alexander was riding in?
Well, yes, it was evidence that was found in the truck that Mr. Alexander was riding in. But there was evidence from the
stolen property found in the truck that Mr. Alexander was riding.
Yes, and there was testimony from the three individuals whose homes were burglarized that they it was their items and they had not given permission to Mr. Alexander to have those items. So
was there any evidence with respect to those incidents of the nature of the break-in, i.e. doors kicking down, what was taken, etc.?
No, Judge Criswell, there was not. It was very straightforward, granted, to the prosecution.
But was the jury informed that there, in fact, had been a burglary in those three instances?
I don't believe so, no.
So essentially, we just had evidence from which a jury could infer that the defendant and his companion were in the possession of stolen items.
That's correct.
And wouldn't that support an inference that the defendant intended to deprive the possessors of, in Boulder, the rightful owners of their property?
It would.
And would
yes.
That in turn not also support an inference that the property that was found from the Evergreen burglaries that the defendant also similarly intended to deprive those owners permanently of their possessions?
Actually, I would back up. I don't believe it does necessarily in show that Mr. Alexander intended to deprive those individuals of that property. The items weren't found in his truck. They were found in Mr. Wagner's truck, his co-defendant's truck. And that's the only connection to Mr. Alexander, is the fact that they were in a truck that he was riding in.
Counsel, apparently the trial court limited the testimony in the manner in which you've described, namely the items found in the truck and owner's testimony. We didn't get permission for anybody to take them. Okay. I gather that as a matter of evidence, there was no evidence, but that in fact the deprivation of property occurred as a result of burglaries.
I'm sorry, would you repeat?
I gather that indeed the Boulder incidents involved burglaries, even though
yes.
The evidence was not presented to the jury in that fashion. My question is, can you recall for me the basis for the trial court's distinction between evidence relating to the nature of the burglaries in those cases and the simple evidence of an inference of possession of stolen property?
Well, I believe that it was for the purpose of identity, if I'm understanding your question correctly, that's why the trial court allowed it to come in, was for the purposes of identity, as was the case.
But why didn't he allow the evidence of the burglaries themselves? Is my question really?
Well, I believe that the trial court was concerned that it would be unduly prejudicial, and so limited it to just that evidence, the fact that these items were stolen from these individuals.
And did the court make an express finding as to why she was allowing the evidence of the possession of stolen items from Boulder residents into evidence? Or was it she just, or are we just inferring that her reason was to set us was under intent of Rule 404B?
I'm not remembering if she did make express findings.
We can conclude that it supports intent. We can affirm her ruling on that, can we not? Even if she did not make such a finding.
I don't, I'm sorry, I don't recall, Your Honor. That is one item I don't recall.
Sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt.
No, that's okay. Thank you. The other evidence, the 404B evidence, was evidence of two burglaries that Mr. Alexander pleaded guilty to. That came in, and all of it came in. And our claim with regard to that evidence is that while it was intended to come in to show identity again, it was much broader than just to show identity. In other words, all of the evidence of those two other burglaries came in.
How do you establish identity short of that?
Well, the identity could have been established by the fact that there were footprints found on the door.
I understand that, but I'm saying if we're talking about the Boulder or the burglaries to which there was a plea taken, how do you establish identity for other charges without establishing basically modus operandi? So that you infer identity from the fact that the incidents were took place in a very similar manner.
Well, yes, and your point is well taken. However, in this situation, there was evidence about what items were taken, and there was testimony from the victims about the burglaries, and our claim would be that this wasn't necessary to show the identity.
No, it wasn't. Weren't these incidents were those that had either fingerprint or DNA evidence connecting the defendant to those incidents, am I correct?
That is correct.
So
yes.
those incidents were rather important in terms of the identity issue.
Yes, and that evidence came in, but along with everything else.
Okay.
And that's our claim that...
I'm just thinking out loud here. I'm wondering about the items that were taken from the two burglaries to which the defendant pled guilty. Were those vastly different, or were they similar to the items taken from the burglaries for which he was on trial? I mean, in other words, if the mm-hmm. nature of the items were similar, they're taking jewelry and those kinds of things, then doesn't that support an inference that the same burglars are working?
Yes. I believe, though, that the items weren't necessarily the typical items that were taken. Actually, let me restate that. It wasn't as if Mr. Alexander and his co-defendant targeted just computers or just jewelry. I mean, they Apparently, according to the testimony, items of all different kinds were taken from the residences. And so I don't believe that it could be said, yes.
So whatever inference we draw from it wouldn't be terribly strong one way or the other.
Well, yes, yeah.
It's not just artwork or animals or something.
That's correct, yes. That's correct. The other evidence that we're challenging that had a cumulative effect is our claim on the failure to provide a fair trial for Mr. Alexander is the photo identification and in-court identification of Mr. Alexander by a witness. Our claim is that the photo identification was impermissibly suggestive because of the two hints that were provided to that witness.
Two hints.
One hint was that the woman's husband had already missed. He had tried to identify Mr. Alexander from a photo array and had
identified the wrong number.
The right person.
But who identified? If I get the scene right, it was the wife of the speaker, the wife of the identifying person, who said, "Oh no, you got it wrong, honey." I think she said, mm-hmm. "It's this one." So it seems like she was the one making the suggestion. It wasn't being a suggestion made to her. Do I have that right? Is that how the testimony came in?
It is, but she had that elimination of that
only in her own mind.
Individual.
She was the one who said, "That's the wrong one. It's this one."
Do we understand that the police officer already indicates to the husband that he had guessed wrong or that he had identified the wrong people?
No.
Okay.
No.
So,
yes.
So how is it that the wife has the advantage of knowing that the husband had identified the wrong person?
Well, it gave her the advantage in that she could look over his shoulder and see which one he was identifying, and that gave her time then to realize that wasn't the correct person, and to then identify someone else, and that was then confirmed by the police officer.
After she already said it's this person?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
But then she went on at the trial to identify Mr. Alexander.
Let me back up a second. I think you said there were two hints, so you talked about one. What was the second one at the time she picked out the photo?
Well, the second hint was that the police officer confirmed that
after she already picked them?
Yes.
Okay.
Exactly. And she wasn't the witness that he was talking to. He didn't give her an advisement. I mean, he was talking to her husband.
Let us assume for just a moment that we conclude that there was no improper action before her photo array identification, okay?
Yes.
The statement by the detective came afterwards that you've got the right one. How, if at all, does this affect the in-court identification?
Well, again, she wasn't the person who had been advised. She wasn't the witness who the detective had confronted with the photo array. And then she later became a witness at trial and was able to use her overhearing, in effect.
My question assumed that we were to conclude that the photo array identification was not tainted. Okay, if we can reach that conclusion, is there still any basis for your argument that the in-court identification was improper?
Well, yes, that it was impermissibly suggestive, based upon the fact that she had essentially been told, you know, that this picture is a picture of the perpetrator.
Ms. Kelly, I need to ask you a question because I'm not sure I understand this. Am I correct in understanding that the identification that we're talking about here, we're talking about a husband and wife who were trying to identify suspects associated with a burglary to which the defendant pled guilty. Am I correct about that? So we're talking about whether the wife or husband correctly identified the defendant as a burglar of an event where he admitted being the burglar. Is that right?
I'm not absolutely sure about this. I believe it is right, though. But it still allowed I believe that is correct.
Okay, well, I'm trying to guess then, what is the incremental harm of this identification? I mean, basically what's going on, as I understand it, is there's been a burglary next door. There was a red truck. Husband and wife are asked to identify the young men or the men who are next to this red truck. And one correctly and one incorrectly identifies the defendant. If the defendant admits that he committed that burglary, why isn't it all just cumulative to his admission that he was there and therefore necessarily was one of the people associated with that red truck?
Well, it isn't cumulative to his admission because it came in at his trial and would be more improper 404B evidence then.
Well, yeah. I guess what I don't understand is this. What was the two individuals who were involved in this photo array ID were not victims?
No, they were just neighbors.
They were just neighbors. Yeah. Okay. And their only testimony was to link the defendant to the red truck? I mean, was that the effect of their testimony?
Well,
I mean, the defendant had already been linked with direct evidence as to the red truck with the stolen property in it.
That's right.
So what effect did the testimony of the photo ID, if its only purpose was to link them to a red truck, have? What? How could it possibly have harmed you?
Well, it would just be more cumulative evidence that Mr. Alexander was involved in a burglary that he had already pled guilty to, and so it would be improper 404B evidence.
Yeah. Respect which there was footprint evidence and DNA evidence as well that identified him with that burglary. And this was just a visual sighting of that. But this was all related to the Klusman burglary, wasn't it? Which he already pled guilty to.
So your argument here is not that it was irrelevant or even prejudicial in the abstract. It's just that it's too much. We just keep hearing more and more about this one burglary to which he'd already pled guilty.
Exactly, and combined with the other 404B evidence that came in, it just had a cumulative effect of denying him a fair trial. And I'm speaking of the Boulder burglaries and then, of course, the Klusman and the Hennies burglaries. So,
thank you.
Okay, thank you.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. May it please the Court. My name is Catherine Hansen, registration number 25464, appearing on behalf of the people in this matter. I would like to briefly, if I could, answer a couple of your questions, Your Honor, Judge Criswell, regarding the reasons for why the court did not allow the burglary evidence but allowed the possession of stolen property, just to clarify the record. Basically, the court, at the time it was hearing this case, hearing the motion to introduce the evidence, there was current case law out there by the name of People versus Skufka. And basically, that case had held that it was error to allow in res geste evidence of cases where there were pending charges, and that impacted the defendant's right to testify. So basically, that's what the defendant had argued, is you can't allow these burglaries in because I'm being currently charged with them, and that will cause me to have a difficult decision about the right to testify. So that's why the burglaries themselves were not allowed. For only that reason, Skufka has since been overturned on that basis. And so,
were the Boulder incident burglaries the subject to pending charges at that time?
Yes.
Okay.
And that was the only basis for not allowing the burglaries. And so, as I mentioned in my brief, I think evidence, if you look at the prosecution's motion in limine and their offer of proof, the burglaries were virtually identical to all of the burglaries here.
Well, that being the case, I'm having trouble finding a 404B basis for evidence simply of a larceny when it's burglary that's being charged.
Well, as I discussed in my brief.
Or either larceny or possession of stolen property. Either.
Correct. And the reason the prosecution explained, and this is perhaps the reason, I don't know that the court, to answer your question as well, I don't know the court articulated why the possession of stolen items in and of themselves was relevant to identity, which basically I do agree it's relevant to intent as well, but it was admitted for the purpose of showing identity, and that was the jury instruction. But basically what the basis is that, and as the prosecution argued, is his possession of the stolen items in the Boulder burglaries in connection with his possession of the stolen items with regard to the Jefferson County burglaries creates a situation where it's less likely, much less likely, that he has innocently come into possession of these items. That in turn creates a reasonable inference that he was involved in the burglaries, likely all of them, but at least as at issue here in this case with the Jefferson County cases.
Saying in effect that even if the stolen property that he was discovered to be, let's assume, jointly in possession of, mm-hmm. came from a pure larceny and no burglary, that it nevertheless was relevant under 404B for the issue of intent. Is that your argument?
I believe the prosecution argued it's relevant to identity. It's relevant to show his possession of, and I realize this takes several steps, but his possession of the stolen items together creates the reasonable inference that his possession of those items is not innocent, that he knows that they're stolen, which then, as we know, creates a reasonable inference that he was involved in the theft of these items. And so the reasonable inference that he was involved in the theft of the Jefferson County items then creates reasonable evidence of his, or reasonable inference of his identity.
I'm buying it, counsel.
I don't get the link.
Let me tell you what I'm seeing.
Okay.
Okay, he's got the stolen items. That will support an inference that he stole the items. So far,
correct.
So good? Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Does that fact support an inference that he broke in and stole the items from these houses? Absent some similarity between the burglary that we are now inferentially ascribing to him and the ones here, I don't see how it does.
It makes it more likely. And that's the thing. I'm not suggesting that the possession of the stolen items from the Boulder cases proves beyond a reasonable doubt that he committed the burglaries in Jefferson County.
On what theory does it make it more likely? Why?
Because his possession of the Boulder stolen items, undisputedly stolen items, makes it more likely that his possession of all of the items is not innocent, that he was gained possession of them by in some illegal manner. And that
he's in the burglary business, maybe.
Well, yes.
He might be a fence and not a burglar. He might be a person who received stolen property and not a burglar.
It could be.
Are you suggesting that proof that a person is a thief leads to the identity of a burglar?
Proof that you're in possession of stolen items, knowing possession of stolen items that were obtained during a burglary.
But you didn't have evidence of that.
But we did.
Well, I thought the evidence was limited to the fact that he was in possession of them without consent of the owner.
I was talking about possession of the stolen items from the Jefferson County burglary.
Oh, okay.
So possession of those items creates the inference that he was involved in the burglaries.
Yeah.
Possession of the Boulder stolen items creates an overall situation where it is very unlikely his possession of any of these items is innocent or by accident were just given to him. So it does require a two-step.
But doesn't that go to the issue of intent, not identity?
I believe it absolutely goes to the issue of identity because they're showing he was the one that was involved in the burglary.
Or does it just show he has a propensity to be in possession of stolen property, which would not be a permissible inference, would it?
Well, I mean, certainly there was no argument. In fact, they never even mentioned the Boulder stolen items in the closing argument. But there has to simply be a logical relevance independent of that. And this is my argument, and this was the prosecution's argument, that his possession of all, and I can quote, viewing all of the offenses to which the defendants are connected as a whole, makes the possibility of innocent explanation for the possession of stolen property from the Evergreen, Clear Creek, and Boulder offenses incredibly remote. So looking at everything together, it makes it less likely that his possession of these items was innocent, which in turn, looking at the Jeffco items, makes it more likely, if we rule out, if we say this rules out the possible, or not rules out, but makes it less likely that there's innocent possession, then that strengthens the inference that he was involved in obtaining the stolen items.
But it's reading from the court's finding or your brief?
My brief.
Oh.
I quoted the prosecution's argument from their...
Okay.
So that was the argument, and that's why I said I don't know that the court made any specific findings. I mean, arguably, in this case, they should have let in all the burglaries. I understand why they didn't. Scuffco was the status of the law at the time, but arguably all of that evidence was admissible.
Oh, and I will tell you that based on the explanation I've heard so far, I do think it is relevant, although not hugely relevant, not hugely probative, on the issue of his intent to permanently deprive.
I absolutely agree.
Now, our problem is that was not what the prosecution argued, and that's not what the court instructed the jury.
Correct.
Can you just address briefly, I guess the potential that in light of the instruction, assuming for the sake of argument that we disagree with you about its relevance for identity, was it harmful? Was it harmless? I mean,
absolutely harmless. And I argued in the brief that in general it was harmless, even if it shouldn't have been allowed at all. It was harmless. There's very, very brief testimony. It was not mentioned at all in closing argument, and there was overwhelming evidence of the defendant's guilt of the charged burglaries in this case. So I totally agree it was admissible for intent as well, to show his intent to permanently deprive. As you know, we are left with the stated purposes. In Usum, I know that they limited their analysis to the purposes for which the jury was instructed, even though the prosecution had argued additional purposes. I think this court can find that the evidence was relevant as to intent on other grounds, as the prevailing party were entitled to do that. But in the event that this court doesn't consider that, at the very most, you can find this any error in admitting this evidence harmless.
But didn't the court, in essence, instruct the jury that it could not consider it for any purpose other than identity?
You know, to be perfectly candid, I looked through my brief and I did not look through the record again as to this, but I don't think it gave a limiting instruction as to the Boulder evidence itself at all.
Oh, okay.
I know it specifically gave a limiting instruction as to the Klusman and Henny's burglaries, but I did not see that in my brief, and I generally will make a note of that when I'm dealing with a 404B. So it's possible that there was no limiting instruction given as to the Boulder, which certainly, assuming this court finds that they should have been properly admitted under 404B, a limiting instruction generally should be given.
Both the limited instruction in your brief, and she limited it to the Henderson Klusman burglary. So
I believe that's what I saw when I was preparing for this. And like I said, to be candid, I believe that had there been a limiting instruction as to those, I probably would have mentioned it.
Counsel, what dovetails, I guess this analysis dovetails to the out of court and in court identification of the husband and wife who were the neighbors of the burglary, mm-hmm. because I guess I would like you to, if you wouldn't mind, address that. And in addressing it, would you discuss the significance of the fact that the defendant actually pled guilty to the burglary that was the subject of the husband and wife's identification?
I think the significance of that fact completely precludes this court from reviewing the claim at all. In Madrid, which is a case I cited, it's practically directly on point. It's a situation where you had two robberies and you had test in trial of one. It was, I believe, an ice cream store, trial of the ice cream robbery. They wanted to introduce evidence of a restaurant robbery, a fast food restaurant. And not only did they address the issue of whether just generally under 404B this evidence was admissible, they went on to address the separate issue of they wanted to suppress identification testimony from the restaurant robbery. And a division of this court said, no, You pled guilty to it. It waives your right to challenge the evidence, even though it's being admitted only as for evidence. That's exactly what we have here. And so I would say under Madrid, it precludes this court's review altogether.
So the evidentiary effect of this identification evidence, am I correct in assuming that it basically is to tie the defendant to the red truck that is seen in the vicinity of all
correct
the other burglaries, the truck that the defendant was riding in when he was stopped?
Correct.
Okay. So that this was a very, it appears to have been a strong case on identity.
Yes. And that was the strategic reason for, not strategic reason, but certainly that's why they pled guilty to those. They realized, they acknowledged these are the very two strongest cases. And I believe their strategy was to try and argue, well, we owned up to the two that you have us on. So that shows that we didn't do the, or he didn't do the others. That was their strategy for pleading guilty in those cases. And so there was really no dispute whatsoever that he committed the two burglaries, one of which, not to mention, he pled guilty.
Evidence of the plea?
I don't believe so. I don't believe so. I don't, I would have probably noted that, and I don't have that, but I do know that that was their argument. That was their reason for why they pled guilty. And so it may have come in just in through argument. If this court has any further questions, I'd be happy to answer them. Okay, thank you very much. We would ask that this court affirm.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Excuse me. That concludes our argument. The court thanks both counsel for their arguments. And there being no further business this afternoon, the division will be in recess and the bailiff.